Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey everyone, this is AJ Woodhams, host of the War Books podcast, where I interview today's best authors writing about war-related topics. Today, I'm so excited to have on author Tom Dunkel. Tom's talking about his new book, White Knights and the Black Orchestra, the extraordinary story of the Germans who resisted Hitler. I love this book so much. This is going to be such a great conversation. Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing well, AJ. And again, I promise I didn't. I apologize for not wearing my tuxedo today, but we'll have to make it work.
No. You look great. For those of you who don't know, Tom is a Washington, D.C. based journalist and author, a former staff features writer at the Baltimore Sun, and a longtime freelancer for publications like the Washington Post magazine and the New York Times magazine. His new book was about the resistance to Hitler within the German government during World War II. And Tom, I thought it was really, really fascinating. I learned so much. Maybe just to get started here. So your book starts in the early 1930s. Can you give the audience some context? What was going on inside Germany? What was going on in the world? What was the political landscape the characters in your book were navigating?
Yeah, it's interesting. Originally, I had at the proposal stage, I was going to begin the book in 1939. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's one of the central characters in the book, spends time in the United States in the fall of 1930. He goes to Union Theological Seminary in New York City to study, and then leaves and comes back in spring of 1930, summer 1939. He manages to get a teaching fellowship at Union Theological Seminary right as things are really heating up, and it looks like war is about to break out in Europe. And so I was going to begin it there, but I found I was flashing back so much to the early years that I decided I just have to basically, I'm going to move the book back to 1930. In the early years, people are thinking, well, you know, Hitler will modify once he gets to power. You know, this is kind of a show. But when you're really faced with the responsibility of leading a country, a lot of his rhetoric is going to tone down and we'll be fine. As you know, that turned out not to be the case and a terrible misjudgment of character and the political backdrop. But as this unwinds from when he's chancellor in the early 30s to as we get deeper into the Nazi period and eventually into the wartime, I gained an appreciation as I was researching this for the context of their moral decisions and the moral dilemmas that the conspirators within the government were faced with. And the image that kept popping into my mind was that these people were sort of trapped in a box canyon where they were looking for, they wanted to do the right thing. They had a moral compulsion to do the right thing and could not really allow themselves not to do the right thing. But the question becomes, well, what exactly can you do, and what impact, what ripple effect impact will it have? Number one, on the country, there was a thought, okay, if we depose of Hitler one way or another, are we going to start a civil war in Germany? And then there's also the more personal question that in the Nazi years, they had that concept of collective guilt. So if I commit a crime, I'm not only held responsible for that, but my extended family is as well. So if you become part of a plot to overthrow the government, you're not only risking your own life, you're risking the life of your whole family. And what is your moral responsibility at that point to, okay, I can risk my life. Do I have a right to risk my wife's life and my children's life and my parents' life? It's these terrible choices that the people were trying to make and how they were, in a way, kind of fumbling in the dark to find both a way to satisfy their conscience and also a way to try to get their country out of this, you know, horrific dilemma they were in.
Yeah. Now, the book is about the Germans who resisted Hitler, but it focuses mostly on two people, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and, am I saying this right? Hans von Danagy?
That's close enough. Von Danagy, yeah.
Okay, von Danagy. Start with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. What kind of person was he? What was he like? Why was he especially suited for this particular role inside government resisting Hitler?
Bonhoeffer was one of those, I guess you could describe him as an intellectual prodigy in a way. As I recall, by the time he was 9 or 10 years old, he had decided he wanted to become, you know, a pastor, which some of his siblings found rather amusing not a proper occupation for an upper class German family. But he was speaking, I've got 3 or 4 languages by the time he was 14 or 15. And then by the time he was, as I recall, by the time he was 20, he had his bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and I think he had finished most of his doctoral work, if not all of it by then. And actually what brings him, part of what brings him to the United States in 1931 is that he had done all of this, and he even had done an assistant pastorship in Barcelona, but he was still too young to be ordained in Germany. He had to be either 24 or 25 years old. So he essentially had some time on his hands. So he decides to come to Union Theological Seminary in New York City, which has a tradition of kind of a progressive activist approach to the ministry. And he gets a fellowship there for, you know, the fall of 30 into the summer of 31. But he was somewhat intimidating to people because he was so smart and extremely well-read and a voracious reader as well, and clearly a man of faith.
And Bonhoeffer, when he was in America, I thought this was really interesting. You write that he was really involved in the African-American community. Is that right?
Yeah. Even to the point of, Abyssinian Baptist Church was the big black church in Harlem. And Adam Clayton Powell Sr. was the pastor at that time. And so you have this young, flaxen-haired German exchange, student rather, coming over to the States. And he, Abyssinian Baptist Church was not the nearest church that he could have gone to. But he was drawn, partly there was a black student at Union Theological Seminary that said, hey, go check this church out. And he checked it out and enjoyed it to the extent that he was actually invited by Pastor Powell to join in the ministry, where he was doing home visits with families. And even culturally in Harlem, Bonhoeffer was was a piano player, and again, quite good. You know, at 8 or 10 years old, he's playing Mozart, you know, on the sonatas on the piano. But he started hanging out, interestingly enough, in the jazz clubs in uptown Manhattan. But he was immersing himself. He made a deliberate effort to immerse himself into American culture, much to his credit. And he was even taking road trips on Christmas breaks and spring breaks and such. And he was keenly aware of the racial divide in the United States at that time, and not attuned to it as a foreigner coming to the States, not yet knowing that what was going to happen over in Germany, where you have an acute ethnic divide with, particularly with Jews and Germans in his own country. But it was sort of a precursor of what he was going to deal with and see over there. But he was talking about he could not understand the level of discrimination in the States and how people could relate to a Duke Ellington as a musician, but the notion of Duke Ellington, you know, eating in the same restaurant with you would just be, you know, more than white people in the States could handle. So he was aware of that sort of that ethnic tension and stew that he has sort of walked into. But he's an interesting guy, and Bonhoeffer, of course, has come to be quite widely read, and but he was conservative in a lot of ways. And, you know, when he would talk about, for example, he thought, well, a husband and wife should have the same opinion about things. He couldn't quite handle because as his life evolves, he gets engaged during the war and is contemplating marriage. But and he said also that a lot of times he was aware that he wouldn't intimidate people with his intellect, and he told his good friend Eberhard Bethge that in a way he was almost a little bit jealous of Bethge. He said, you know, you're very easygoing and people relate to you, where people seem to, I seem to come off as very somewhat stern with other people. But he was a charismatic guy, there's no question about it, and deeply, deeply committed to his faith. And of course his faith would bring him into conflict with the political establishment, and Dagnani was his brother-in-law, and others were faced with that dilemma. And Dagnani being a Christian as well, where is, you know, how active should you be as a Christian? And when they get to the point where they're thinking of assassinating Hitler, then there's a lot of there's a religious and ethical dimension to that as well. You know, it's interesting. There was his brother Klaus also got active in the resistance, a little bit more on the civilian, and he was an attorney at Lufthansa Airlines. But his wife Emmy, after the war, she was talking about how she wrestled with the notion of what the whole family went through. Because, you know, Bonhoeffer, without doing spoiler alerts here, I mean, there was a number of friends and family who wound up getting killed. And Emmy Bonhoeffer admits that after the war, where she's thinking, you know, this was such a blood-soaked period of time, you know, was it worth resisting? But then she went on to say that, and there was a quote from her in a letter where she goes, people think that the resistance, and I'm closely paraphrasing here, people think that the resistance was a matter of choice or free will, but there really was no choice. I mean, they knew the risks, but they could not let themselves be passive. So there was that feeling that you have no choice. So the question becomes, well, then the next step of that is, well, what exactly do we do? And that's what a lot of the conspirators were wrestling with throughout the war. And particularly as it got to the point where it looked like what we have to do is frankly kill him, meaning Hitler.
Yeah, the moral call to action was really fascinating. Let's talk about Hans von Danagy. What kind of person was he? Why was he especially suited for this role?
Yeah, Hans Danagy is... Bonhoeffer is, I think, fair to say, well-known, you know, here in the States, certainly in Germany. And he's one of the more well-known resistors and activists during World War II. His brother-in-law, Hans Danagy, gets very short shrift, and he's not as well-known as I think he should be. He was an attorney and an early, and again, very... Bonhoeffer being precocious as a theologian and an intellect, Danagy was people were quite impressed by his intellect and by his capabilities as an attorney. And he started off in one of the ministries of commerce or economics, but quickly got a job was brought into the Ministry of Justice at I think he was 25 at the time, which is the age when he marries Dietrich's sister, Christine. And again, a person of, people who interacted with him during the war felt that he could be kind of, I don't want to say prudish, but kind of, Bonhoeffer, I think, had a little bit more of a instant personal charisma with people. Danagy was, I think, fair to say, very businesslike. And he was determined from as soon, he met Hitler early on, which is 33 or 34, he's in a meeting with Hitler. And he comes back from that meeting and tells his wife, you know, this guy's crazy, he's mad. And he begins, in 34, starting to keep what is like one could think is a running diary, but it was really kind of a dossier on the Nazi movement and regime, specifically not just atrocities, but even any kind of thing within the government that smelled wrong to him. And in the back of his mind, it was that at some point there's going to be an accounting one way or another. And that this would be, he's thinking as an attorney here, valuable evidence to document what was going on here. And even doing that, and even when he started doing it early on, was at some risk to his life. In fact, he took great precautions where he was typing his notes, I think as I recall, it was a dozen different typewriters that he was using, because he didn't want to be traced in any way. And a couple of people knew what he was doing, including Hans Gertner, who was the Minister of Justice, who let him proceed on his way with that. But he became sort of he actually called it a chronicle, but he was chronicling. He felt this compelling need to chronicle the Nazi regime. And then he becomes increasingly activist, and he reaches a point, and he's known for that within some circles of the government. And another character that enters the narrative is Wilhelm Canaris, who was the head of the Abwehr, which was the overseas military intelligence, where we could sort of think of that as analogous perhaps to the CIA for people not familiar with Abwehr. But Canaris was a career military man, and an interesting, again, when you speak about divided loyalties and complexities of enduring the Nazi regime, Canaris was the highest up of a number of these conspirators, and he was using the Abwehr as a way to shelter people, particularly at Abwehr headquarters. And Abwehr, there was, as you get deeper into the war, I think there's 10,000, you know, people working for the Abwehr. But within headquarters, he has essentially a cell of about 40 or 50 anti-Hitler conspirators that he is giving free rein and shelter to. And he brings Danyany into the Abwehr right after the invasion of Poland in September 39, because by then Danyany had had a reputation within these circles, within the government, of both being a man of high character and integrity, but also being someone who was drawn to being an activist, and we have to do something about Hitler's.
So within government, how many people would you say were actually in the Black Orchestra, which is this group of resistors within government that you write about?
You're not going to get a firm number on something like that because, number one, it was too dangerous, and not like you could have a meeting of all the Black Orchestra people. Let's get together and talk about killing Hitler. It would depend on what level you're speaking of. In other words, within the Abwehr, that core group, and again, people are active on different levels, but within the Abwehr, there's estimated to be about 40 people who know what's going on and who are involved in conspiring. They, of course, are in touch with people within the military, particularly generals out in the field, because one of the concerns they had was, okay, if we kill Hitler, it's not going to do much good if we don't have a sort of a core group of in the military that's going to support us, because if you kill him and they decide to just continue with business as usual with the Nazi government, what have we really accomplished? So they felt that they had to get that indefinable but sort of gut feeling of enough high-level people in the military to support this. And that it was quite interesting. Within the German military, they were required, and I think this is, and I can't remember exact year, it's either in 33 or 34. When you were in the military, you take an oath to your country. Well, that changed when Hitler became chancellor, and in 33 or 34, you start taking the oath to Hitler, to the Führer. And among the officer corps, you take a loyalty oath, and they take it seriously. But there was also an enormous sense of professionalism and loyalty to your fellow officers. And to the point where they would be able to discuss quite openly among themselves, and again with people on the fence or some people that weren't even in favor of the conspiracy, quite openly talk about assassinating Hitler. And there was a number of those officers and generals and majors and colonels that could have betrayed the conspirators, but did not do that. I mean, there was almost an overriding sense of loyalty to your fellow officers. So to put a number, it certainly was in the several hundreds as this conspiracy expands. And then there's two coup attempts in 38 and 39, in which, you have a number of, we shoot Hitler, but then we got to take control of the government after that. And they have to be, there were officers who were part of, we're going to take our men out in the field. We'll take control of the streets of Berlin. We'll do that. So people were cooperating. So certainly within the several hundreds had a notion and were active in it. And then beyond that, there's all sorts, part-time players in it. But I would say that in terms of the Black Orchestra, think of it as 40 or 50 in that core group. A group of several hundred that extended to officers who were complicit and cooperating, and then beyond that, you had more people who were sympathetic and might have joined the conspiracy when you get to the situation in July of 44 with the Valkyrie bombing.
I've noticed a lot of the resistors that you write about were in they were in more of an elite class. There were aristocrats, upper class people, people with privileged backgrounds.
I mean, that was, that's essentially, it's certainly in the officer officer corps and in the diplomatic corps.
Why do you think that was?
Well, that's largely the way a lot of societies work, is that your elites tend to run things. So, and particularly in the older European countries, you have your established. Same thing was going on in Britain. I mean, you have your established, your upper class, both in business and politics, and in the military, that's not unusual. And particularly in those situations, it was interesting because partly because of how old the countries are, you have those interlocking family trees. I mean, it was quite interesting how many members of the upper class in Germany were related to each other. Everybody seems to be a cousin or a second cousin. That was just the way the culture and the society functioned then. But it was particularly if you're speaking within that upper echelon of the government, it's going to be mostly of the upper class. And in fact, Dagnani makes a comment as we're getting into the later, darker, final days of the war. He is befriended by a medical doctor, one of the police doctors. And they start talking politics, and he mentions what by that. And again, spoiler alert territory here, but he is in prison at one point. He's talking about the resistors he meets on a lower level, meaning not people necessarily from the upper class in prison, and how impressed he was with those people. And he expresses his dissatisfaction with the upper class in Germany and the officer class in Germany, that they could have and should have done more. And if they had, and particularly if they'd done it early on, then the Nazis would not have spun out of control. And in other words, the time to stop Hitler was early, and not enough people stood up at the right time to do it. People who were in a position of authority and responsibility that could have done something.
Let's talk about the title of your book, White Knights in the Black Orchestra. So I've heard of the Red Orchestra before. I think maybe a lot of other people have, which is the nickname that the Nazis gave to a famous group of resistors in Germany. But I had never heard of the Black Orchestra until I read your book. Talk a little bit about that. Why is it called the Black Orchestra?
Yeah, there's a two-track explanation of the title, and as one gets deeper in the book, the meaning becomes clear. The Black Orchestra was, in essence, a slang term. It's believed to have started with the Gestapo, and again, it preceded the Black Orchestra. There was the group, the Red Orchestra, and kind of the linguistic background of this is that if you had a resistance group, they would often have a radio, to communicate. And in those days, you were communicating by radio by Morse code, tapping out Morse code messages, which is analogous to somebody playing a piano. That's kind of the etymology behind the word. And okay, the radio operator was the piano player, then and other people are going to be part of the orchestra. So hence, that description of a resistance group. And the Red Orchestra was a group of civilian resistors. And there was a couple of different clusters, smaller group of people. And they had a number of them had sympathies with Russia, and not all of them, but in terms of the slang terminology that became adopted within the Gestapo, that group became known as the Red Orchestra. And they were, as I recall off the top of my head, they were arrested, I think, in fall of 42. They finally got discovered and arrested and go on trial. The Black Orchestra, a group within the government, Gestapo and people in the military become aware of them after that. And it was just an evolution of the term. I've got, and the Black Orchestra, I guess, being more sinful to be within the government and resisting, but that they adopted that slang expression for the Black Orchestra.
So the Red Orchestra never actually, they never called themselves that. It's a name that the Gestapo gave them.
That's where they believe the evolution of the term came from within the Gestapo. Just their shorthand way of referring to these people. Yeah.
And the Black Orchestra was the same thing. They never actually called themselves the Black Orchestra.
No, that was a Gestapo term as well, and a sort of a slang term that was thrown around as they're doing their investigations. But no, they didn't refer to themselves as anything. They didn't have a name for themselves.
So what were some of the activities that the Black Orchestra was doing? What were some of the different ways that they were organizing and resisting Hitler?
Yeah, well, for example, in 1938, Hitler, he tells his, as I recall, it was in November in 37, he actually tells, he has a meeting with his top tier generals, and that's where he uses that expression that every generation needs a war, and I'm gonna see that our generation has this war. Where he is in his own head is making plans to expand beyond the borders of Germany, and the first excursion is into Austria, and then and that's the Anschluss is in March 38, I think. That was the first domino to kind of fall, and it felt pretty peacefully. Next up, he had his eye on Czechoslovakia and the Sudetenland area of Czechoslovakia, which was had a German population. And Hitler's using that as kind of a wedge issue that the Germans are being mistreated in the Sudetenland. We have to go in there and save them and blah, blah, blah. At that point, they actually begin to talk about an outright coup attempt of some, and one of the, again, there's a couple of tracks they're pursuing here. One of which is, which perhaps sounds naive or overly optimistic, was that they were going to put Hitler under arrest and put him on trial and try to dispose of him without violence. And parenthetically, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's father was a psychologist and psychiatrist. They were going to have Bonhoeffer's father, again, through contacts with his conspirators and with Dagnani, who's his son-in-law. Bonhoeffer's father was going to be the person who was to do the medical evaluation on Hitler and declare him insane when they put him on trial. So that conspiracy is rolling to the point where they have it organized and they have managed to collect munitions. They have a plan for little safe houses in Berlin. And Hitler makes there was a couple of the top tier generals who were on the fence about cooperating with the conspiracy, were the generals who would have the authority to actually call troops to arms against the government. They get cold feet. Hitler makes a comment and they get the sense that maybe Hitler has gotten the sense that there's a coup in motion, and they call it off and they talk about burning all the files. So that's in fall 38.
So at first the plan was just to arrest Hitler and put him in jail, not actually kill him.
That was the hope. Although as a conspiracy within the conspiracy, Hans Oster was fair to say at that point, kind of the hub of the wheel in terms of actually planning and being a conduit between military people and people within the ADVAR. He was sort of the coordinator of this. He has a Major Heinz who was in charge. He was going to be in charge of the assault unit that was going to storm the chancellery and take Hitler into custody. privately after a meeting, Oster and Major Heinz, Friedrich Heinz, I believe is his first name, they get together between themselves and they say, listen, no matter what Hitler does, whether he cooperates or not, shoot him. So that was not authorized by the entire conspiracy at that point. There was, again, people of conscience here. General Ludwig Beck was another high up general who was involved with the resistance and with the coup, and an old time classic honorable Prussian military man. He was uncomfortable just with the notion of assassination, just morally uncomfortable with assassinating the head of the government, and had certainly had his articulated his reasons for that. So there was that wrestling match that was kind of going on at what point, and later on, Beck consents that this is really the only way out of this. But at that point in 38, the hope was theoretically to take Hitler into custody, or, you know, arrest him, put him on trial, get him declared mentally incompetent or whatever. And if the military, enough people in the military went along with it, they could ease him out of the chancellorship that way.
As the war progresses, though, the goal is always assassination. Just kill Hitler, because arresting him is out of the question by this point.
That becomes more, yeah. By the time they get to 39, they're, you know, after the invasion of Poland, the conspiracy heats up again, and they try. There's again that thought of a coup at that point, but the notion is that it's pretty. Probably going to have to be an assassination attempt, and then that fails with the actual invasion of Poland, because at that point, Britain declares war and Germany is now at war. It's difficult, if not impossible, to get the officer corps to revolt when the country's at war. You know, all out. War. I mean, you know, it's sort of self-preservation of the fatherland at that point.
Tell us about the assassination attempts, because I thought those were really interesting. What were some of the ways that the people in this group, what were some of the ways that they tried to kill Hitler?
For example, in March 39, they came very close to killing Hitler with a bomb that was put on his airplane. And they did that with, again, organized out of the Abwehr, Canaris signing off on this, and in consultation with some officers on the Russian front. And the way it evolved is they had a plan where Germany goes into Russia in June of 41. And Hitler originally thought, foolishly, that was going to go a lot quicker than it did. And then eventually he winds up getting bogged down in winter time there. Anyhow, by 43, they're still fighting on the Russian front. And Hitler has a headquarters close to the Russian front. And they sort of maneuver him into visiting what was called Army Group Center, which is one of the headquarters on the front, which is in Smolensk. And they kind of conspire through military officers who know somebody on Hitler's staff to get Hitler to stop at Army Group Center and kind of do a PR visit to the troops and to the generals in the field there. And at that point, he's traveling by plane, and unbeknownst to one of the officers accompanying on a plane, did not know what this package contained, but one of the conspirators tells him that, oh, I lost a bet with someone, bet one of the generals back in Berlin. I owe him a couple of bottles of Cointreau. Can you put this on the plane and take it? And of course, it was not Cointreau in that package. It was plastic explosive. And they get it on board, and it's in the storage compartment. And where the attempt failed was at the plastic explosive, wherever it was, I guess it was in the hold on the plane. It was just too cold that basically the plastic explosive, the mechanism triggered, but basically the plastic explosive froze up, which created the awful dilemma. And the some hearts were pounding in Smolensk and in Berlin because they had to go retrieve this package before it ever got to that general who was going to get it, who would thereupon open it up and find a bomb inside and not two bottles of Cointreau. And so
I can imagine setting all this up and then getting the phone call that not only did the plan not work, not only did you not kill Hitler, but then realizing you've actually got to go back and retrieve the bomb.
Lieutenant Fabian Schlabrendorf was the person who got on a mail plane the next day from Smolensk, from the front. Goes to Berlin, and then, as I recall, at that point, the package might have been in Wolf's Lair, which is Hitler's little military headquarters outside. He calls ahead and said, "Oh, listen, I made a mistake. I gave the guy the wrong package," and manages to get there in time and retrieve the bomb. And they actually take the explosive, and they try to in essence recycle it a week later. They got another general, Gerstorf, who volunteered to do a suicide bombing. And this again is a week or 10 days later. Hitler was due to do a review of armaments captured that were on display at the armory in Berlin. And Gerstorf, Avar was involved in kind of the planning of this display. And so they could contrive a situation where Gerstorf had a reason to be there and was going to greet Hitler and walk him through the exhibit and this and that. So he takes the plastic explosives with him. And the one glitch they had was Gerstorf wanted a fuse that he could trigger instantaneously. And they could not get a fuse like that quickly enough. And I believe the fuse that he wound up using had a 10-minute timer on it. And so he greets Hitler as he walks into the armory, and he triggers Hitler's with a cluster of people, and Gerstorf is trying to get close to him and walk with him, and he triggers this bomb. And then Hitler, whether, you know, I doubt he was tipped off or whether he was running behind schedule or whether he had kind of a sixth sense at times of whether he was in any danger. But he was due to, as I recall, spend a half hour in this exhibit and winds up speeding through in about 2 or 3 minutes. And so Gerstorf is kind of hustling after him, trying to get close enough. And Hitler's gone. And he had a wreath laying ceremony at the armory out in the quadrangle area there. So he's outside and Gerstorf is no longer close to him. So Gerstorf has to run off and go to a men's room and dismantle the bomb. So that was another attempt. There was another one where another suicide bomb attempt where a captain had, Hitler was very hands-on in terms of he wanted to see new armaments or new equipment. He liked to personally see this before he would sign off on a lot of it. And they had designed some, as I recall, it was winter warfare backpacks and overcoats, a new generation of this. And there was actually a, if you want to call it a fashion show, but a couple of the officers were going to parade around in this new gear for him. And there was a captain, again, who volunteered to do a suicide bombing and he was picked to be, you know, the model, as it were, to display this new winter warfare equipment. And the first attempt got Hitler's schedule was notoriously fluid for security reasons, so they had one setup for this that got canceled at the last minute. They came back and they were going to do it again. And I think this is in December of 43 at this point. But what happened is that there was the Allies at this point, there's a lot of bombing going on, and Allies are doing a lot of bombing of Germany and particularly Berlin. And they wound up bombing the, not that it was targeted, but they bombed the supply train that that contained this shipment of new military clothing and equipment that Hitler was going to take a look at. So they canceled that that unveiling for him. So that attempt missed. And then, of course, later on, there's the July 44, there's the Valkyrie bombing attempt with Klaus von Stauffenberg that's memorialized by Tom Cruise in the movie that a lot of people are familiar with. And that's the one that came the closest to actually killing Hitler. And there was other, now I'm thinking about, you know, again, there was another, the bombing attempt, which was not part of the conspiracy per se, which was the, it was, if you want, for want of a better word, a rogue conspirator, which is a gentleman by the name of George Elser, did a bombing attempt on Hitler in November of November 38, as I recall, in Munich, in the beer hall in Munich, and that bomb went off as well. I mean, that he killed killed about a dozen people that day. But Hitler, he left early and went back to Berlin, and he had had, again, this was a meticulously planned, this guy planned this attempt for about a year, where he actually had moved to Munich and would go have dinner in this beer hall almost every night. And it sounds incredible, but he was actually hiding in the beer hall at night after it closed. And he was meticulously carving out, it was a column with a, you know, wooden facade, panels around it. So he broke into this column and he was carving out, chipping away, creating a space big enough for a bomb to be in there. But he was planning this for a year and actually planned it pretty meticulously. And it actually, the bomb went off, but it was just, you know, maybe a half hour of timing difference, 20 minutes, and history would have been different. But
so the famous assassination attempt, the movie Valkyrie with Tom Cruise was made about the July 20th plot. What were Bonhoeffer and von Danagni, what was their involvement in the July 20th plot?
At that point, they don't have any involvement there. And, you know, Valkyrie being the most well-known plot, I think, in part because, at least in the States here, in part because of the Tom Cruise movie. But you have to look at that plot as a continuum of events that were, you know, began again from Danagni's perspective, he was an active conspirator starting in about 1934. He and Bonhoeffer and a few others get arrested in April of 43. Oster gets arrested a little bit. Oster at that point is thrown out of the military. He's not arrested. He's essentially goes into a quasi house arrest situation and moves out of Berlin. And Oster was again considered kind of the glue at the center, the hub at the center of the wheel at that point. So there's a period of not floundering, but they're wondering, okay, what is the next phase of this? And in the summer of 43, a couple of the conspirators who were left, and there's a civilian, a couple of the civilians and Beck, they are actually introduced by a doctor friend of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's father, who makes an introduction between this young lieutenant colonel, Klaus von Stauffenberg, and some members of the conspiracy. And if any, eventually meets Beck and Karl Gordler, who's the one of the civilian leaders of the military, and they both get a sense that Von Stauffenberg was a very charismatic guy, and they get a sense that, okay, this is our man who can replace Oster as sort of a hub of this wheel, if you were. And the conspiracy at that point essentially moves out of Abwehr, where Oster was based, and over to Army Group Headquarters, where Stauffenberg is based. And Stauffenberg becomes the key person in the sense, not only in planning, is because he is in a position of getting close to Hitler. He gets promoted to a position on the Army command staff that would put him in not regular, but occasional contact with Hitler. And he's also motivated personally motivated to the extent where he's willing to do a suicide bomb. And he tries there was a couple attempts before Valkyrie where they called it off. One was because Stauffenberg had a bomb, and again, they're back at these plastic explosive bombs. He has a bomb in his briefcase at one particular meeting, but he didn't want to explode that bomb because he wanted some more members of the German high command to be in that meeting. And as I recall, Goering was not there, and I think maybe he was hoping Himmler would be there, but not enough. Hitler was there, but not enough of his key people that he didn't want to do that bomb attempt. Then he has one in early July of 44, where Hitler leaves, and it's at the Wolfslehr headquarters, his military headquarters. Hitler happens to leave, again, with his schedule being somewhat unpredictable. Von Stauffenberg is there. He has a bomb in the briefcase. Hitler leaves the meeting earlier than he was expecting. Then a week or so later is the July 20th attempt, where that's the one where it actually comes to fruition. And they had, there was other conspirators on site. As I recall, General Feldjibel was in charge of communications. He was going to get the word out when the bomb goes off on site. He's going to phone back to Berlin and say, okay, they had plans for certain generals to call up some troops, take over the streets of Berlin, and essentially go into a lockdown situation at Army High Command and some things. And they were aware, even though they were in prison at this time, they were still, in fact, one of their methods of communication was via books. They would have coded messages. You were allowed to get, I think about once a week, you could get a food package and reading material. So they were communicating through code, little underlines. They would really faint underlines. They would put, like, on every 10th page in a book, they would underline one consonant or vowel. And you'd have to go through a whole book to figure out what the message was. But they were communicating in large part through Hans von Dejani's wife, who was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's sister, Christine, who was still in touch with some of the members of the conspirators who had not yet been arrested. At that point, Oster had not yet been arrested. Canaris had sort of stepped back a little bit, but they were aware that the July conspiracy bombing was in motion. They were aware that Stauffenberg had joined the conspiracy. So they knew what was going on. In fact, I think it was about 2 weeks before the bombing. I don't know how he described their relationship. It was Bonhoeffer's mother's cousin, General Paul Heyse, who was essentially the commandant of Berlin and also had authority for the prisons. About it was 2 or 3 weeks before the July 20 bombing, he actually comes to see Bonhoeffer in prison. Bonhoeffer is being held at that point in Tegel prison in Berlin, and spends about 5 hours there, and actually brings, I think it was either 4 or 5 bottles of sparkling wine he brought with him. And at this point, he was an active member. You know, he was a key member of the conspiracy at that point, because again, he was gonna call up some of his men to take control of some of the streets of Berlin. And Hayes knows, Bonhoeffer doesn't know the exact day that the bombing is coming, but he knows this is in motion and something's happening imminently. When his uncle, if you will, he called him Uncle Paul. When Uncle Paul comes to see him in prison and spends 5 hours with him, he knows something is happening very quickly.
So Bonhoeffer and von Danagy, what lands them in prison isn't actually, they didn't get caught plotting to try and kill Hitler. What actually lands them in prison is financial crimes, right?
Yes, essentially they were caught funneling money within Abwehr. And this, when you speak to Hans Danagy as a person and his sense of conscience, this is a perfect example. And it wind up, you could argue, in essence, unraveling the conspiracy for them. They had developed when the deportations start. And forgive me for some of my trying to remember off the top of my head. I believe the first deportation of Jews out of Berlin, I'm trying to remember if it's October 41 or 42, but I believe it's 41 at that point when they first start. Bonhoeffer becomes, there's a woman who works, Bonhoeffer was active in what became a splinter movement within the Lutheran church called the Confessing Church. And these were, if you want, for want of a better word, progressive Lutherans who wanted no part of the Nazi regime and in their own way were doing, if you want to call it, conspiratorial activities. But there was a secretary there who was of, as a lot of people in Germany, had become unsafe to be a practicing Jew. But you were still of Jewish heritage and you were still considered a Jew in the eyes of government and therefore a target for deportation. So Bonhoeffer gets concerned that this woman, Charlotte Friedenthal, may be sent to one of the camps. And he wants to do, you know, what can we do to try to help her? So he talks to Danagy. Danagy was in touch with a couple of other Jews in Berlin who had approached him back in 36 because they were losing their law licenses and he couldn't do much for them other than delay that a little bit. They came to see him around that same time and it turns out their families are on a deportation list. So they have developed a plan which originally was 7 people and it was called Operation 7 and it eventually grew to 14 people, 14 Jews that they're going to get out of the country. And the way they do it, with Canaris's approval, and it sounds almost too good to be true, but Canaris winds up convincing Heinrich Himmler and the SS to sign off on this plan where they're going to send some Jews abroad to be spies for the German government, because who's going to ever expect these people who've been expelled from Germany that would actually be spying for us? So they get them out to Basel. Again, there's 14 of them. And what they did is they diverted money from Abwehr operation funds. Hans Danagy felt that for these people to leave the country, they would have to leave everything behind, all their property, all their possessions. And he said, we can't just dump these people in another country without giving them a money stake. So the what worked out to be about what would be the equivalent of about $100,000. They diverted that into a secret pot of money to essentially be a grub stake, if you will, for these families that they were relocating to Switzerland. And there were some people in the accounting department of the Abwehr who were not part of this conspiracy, who started to get suspicious about that. And then coincidentally, there was a guy in the Abwehr based in Munich who was not a part of this conspiracy, but he was doing some illegal activity on the black market. And he got discovered and gets arrested and he gets put under questioning and tortured. And he knew he was not a real active member of the conspiracy. He was helping, you know, he may have had some help in terms of this signing off on some of this money they were diverting, but he wound up when he was getting tortured, he breaks. So that sets into motion the arrests of Bonhoeffer, Dognani, and another conspirator by the name of Joseph Mueller are all arrested on the same day in April of 1943. But that is when the heat starts to be turned up on the Abwehr, where it becomes the German government gets more suspicious that there are people within the Abwehr that are actually active in conspiracies. And even Canaris, as clever as he was in covering his tracks, he becomes an object of suspicion within the government at that point. And it's not until a bit later that he's actually discovered, though. But that was sort of the beginning of the unwinding in April of 43 when those guys get arrested.
So why is this story important?
I think it's important on a couple levels. I think on the one level, again, it's just on the issue of a number of these people are at least here in the, and I was writing for a general interest audience, and particularly a general interest American audience, that I don't think is fair to say is aware of what was going on, that as much was going on inside the government as that time, and also specific people who were really active. And again, Hans Dognani is a person who is not well known before, and there were some other people. Helmuth Moltke, we didn't get a chance to mention. He's another attorney in Abwehr who was involved in the conspiracy and a very interesting guy. So that there was more of an appreciation of what was being done inside the German government. And also, again, the notion of putting a lens on this where you get more of an appreciation of just what a difficult position those people were in. And also, this is not ancient history. If we look at what's going on in Europe right now, and frankly, some of what's going on in our country right now, and we all know about the resurgence of fascism around the world, and people of conscience did not end after, it's not a concept for history. Acts of conscience take place in real time and all the time, but there are certain pivot points of history where people are called upon to make decisions and act morally more than others. And we are both to some extent in our country, but it's going on in a number of countries around the world right now where moral conscience is, this is a time to where your conscience is tested. And that's where I think looking at people who went through the same thing before, again, you're not going to have exact parallels in political or social situations, but there are sure, there's a lot of commonality in what went on in Germany in the 30s and 40s and what's going on in places around the world today. And how do people respond? What is the right thing to do? And then you, ideally with a book like this, you want readers to ask the question, what would I have done, or where is my line and what would I do? There's a, just very quickly, I mentioned Helmuth Moltke, very interesting guy, but he was, again, from a well-known upper-class German family. His great-granduncle had been a hero of the Franco-Prussian War, and they had a 1,000-acre land grant, and this was a well-established family. And he becomes part of the conspiracy. And there is a point, I'm trying to think of, this must have been in 42, because it's after the Germany goes into Russia. And his specialty is international law. So, and particularly he was aghast at some of the violations of the Hague Convention and rules of war and civilians being killed. And he's looking at the statistics from the Russian front. And he breaks it down. And my, I think this is correct. These numbers are coming across his desk. And there's 15,000 Russians being killed a day and 10,000 Germans. And he breaks it down into how many are being killed an hour, how many are being killed by the minute. And he's writing letters to his wife, who is taking care of the family farm in Silesia while Helmuth is spending most of his time in Abwehr in Berlin. He's got a little apartment there. And he writes to her one night, right? And it's after he's looking at these numbers. And he says, you know, how can I sit here sipping my tea? And the phrasing is something on the order of, it says, and what will I say when people ask, and what did you do at that time? I mean, the moral weight that these guys were carrying, and it was on their minds every day, but he was acutely aware of, you're in a moment of time where action is required and called for, and are you going to step up to the moment and take action and do something? Or there was a lot of people who were content to just keep sipping their tea. He was not one of those people.
Thomas, has been a really terrific conversation. I've learned so much. I loved your book. I love these stories. Particularly, I really enjoyed the stories of courage that you highlighted in your book. You know, I think this is a really timely piece here. Now, if someone wants to find you, where can they find you? Or do you have social media? Are you online?
Oh, they can start at my website, which is tomdunkel.com. I'm on Twitter. I think it's tomdunkel_1. May also just very quickly make one commercial, not commercial announcement, but I want to just express my thanks, as a number of writers do, to the National Endowment of the Humanities. The NEH gave me a grant for this project, which was hugely helpful, particularly for those of us writers who were writing during the pandemic, which kind of threw all of our research and everything off kilter. So it's very interesting. The NEH is one of the few things in the government that both Republicans and Democrats agree about these days. But I just would like to acknowledge the work that they do for writers and for projects like this. Yeah, but certainly the website is the easiest way to reach me, and I respond to any questions and complaints and criticisms 24/7. So
that's great. That's great. Well, everyone, White Knights and the Black Orchestra, the extraordinary story of the Germans who resisted Hitler. Go buy it. Go check it out from the library. It's really a terrific book. I really appreciate you coming on today. I really loved our chat. And hope you'll join us again. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, AJ. My pleasure.